From the studios of WRPI, wait a minute, I didn't want that. From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. I'm here this afternoon with Fong Abu. Say hi, Fong.
Hello.
And we will be your hosts for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. Hopefully Phil and Lil will be here also. Don't know for sure at this point. At any rate, this is episode 29 of Little Brother, dated the 29th of December 2001. How cool is that? Stay tuned. Little Brother's right around the corner. And you are listening to Little Brother. Unfortunately, again this week, the phones are still out of commission. So we're going to have to pass on taking any of your phone calls. However, if you want to send us a comment, you can please feel free to do so by sending me an email at critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That address again is critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. Also, if you don't have access to email, you can send me snail mail by sending it to WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Troy, New York, 12180, and send that to Box 31 at 1 WRPI Plaza, and that'll get to me. So without further ado, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union, and that responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for rebuttal. I'm going to take a minute here, and we're going to go into the first thing that we have tonight, or this afternoon rather, is an interview I did last Sunday with Doug Smith, who is the owner of several domains and suffered from spam.
Unsolicited commercial email, or spam as it's frequently called, is a problem that we all deal with pretty much on a daily basis if we use the internet. Now, for the average user, the end result is that you have some extra emails that you have to delete, and this is not a big problem. However, the true cost of spam is often disguised, and to demonstrate this point, I spoke last Sunday with Doug Smith, who operates several websites, and got hit very hard with a spam attack. We started by asking Doug, what happened?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I had been gone most of the day. I think it was one day last week. And I came home and, my God, there were 10,000 messages being downloaded all of a sudden in my email account. And I went, oh, no. Because Eudora will give you an indication as to just how much you're downloading.
Mm-hmm.
So I begin downloading it thinking that it's spam and that And I can just delete all this stuff, but as I'm downloading, the count is going up. And then all of a sudden, I'm disconnected from the internet. And I don't know exactly what happened, and when I dialed back in, I had 45,000 waiting for me. And then Eudora crashed. And then I was unable to get back in for that evening. I tried later to Telnet, to my shell account, to check my mail that way. And now I was up to close to 50,000 email messages, and I was unable to delete anything in my email account using the Pine message reader.
Mm-hmm.
I was just hopelessly stuck. And I tried contacting my ISP for help. They were closed for the weekend.
Ouch.
I mean, they were just not available. It was a horrible experience. So here I was, a small business person, out in the backwoods in southern Maryland. My telephone links to help, non-existent. And 50,000 messages in my email basket, all from .usa.com.
Now, it had come out previously in conversations via email with Doug that apparently what .usa had been doing was to assign random strings of characters in front of the at sign on the email addresses that were sent to his domain. I asked Doug to expand on this a little bit.
Well, exactly. I have a domain that I use called dougsmith.net, and I have any email that goes to that domain using any name is forwarded to a master account that I download every day. And normally I might get one or two messages a week to that because it only appears on one of my web pages. But somebody harvested one of the addresses, one of these spam harvesters, and I've been getting spam addressed to that address. Well, what this company did was put random usernames on this domain, beginning with the letter A, and probably was beginning to work through the alphabet, because by message number 50,000, it had gone from like AA to AK with just random usernames beginning with the letter A. It was very strange.
That is unbelievably brazen.
And it actually, that particular email address is hosted at a place in Arinda, California called namesecure.com, and I can theoretically turn off forwarding. I tried to go do that, and that service wasn't working. I finally got a hold of them a day and a half, 2 days later, and they took care of of shutting it off, but by then it was too late. I actually reached a point where I was unable to use my email account for 3 days. Some mysterious person at my ISP finally deleted about 42,000 messages, and I managed to delete the remaining 8,000.
I asked Doug whether this was his personal or business website.
It's used as part of the business. I purchased it because I wanted to be, one of the guys that had a cool domain like that, and it's on my... it is also an address that I use URL forwarding on so that I can tell if my domain is down or up. There have been prior occasions where I would try to connect to one of my websites, and it would look like it was up to me because I was dialed in to the same network where the website was. And I didn't have a way of checking it from the outside world. And what this does, URL forwarding, allows me to go to www.dougsmith.net, and it'll tell me if the domain dougweb.com is up or down, which is my personal website.
I asked Doug if this was the home of the popular wireless website, which is how I initially came to know him.
It was at one point. Mm-hmm. So it really is more, it doesn't serve any real useful purpose now, other than, but the whole point was that company just had no business doing what they were doing. It amounted to a denial of service attack.
I wondered whether or not this had any effect on his ability to do business.
Everything for popularwireless.com goes there. Everything for dougweb.com goes there. All of my domains forward there. I was pretty much dead in the water, except I was able to let my users know I could use one of those Yahoo accounts that I have for free.
Mm-hmm.
But then, that isn't the address that's all over my website. I was receiving email, from some readers saying, well, how come you're not answering your email? They sent it on the NoGraph account. I think you were one of them. And one of my moderators, Paul Shin, sent me an email message wondering what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awkward. You feel like you're trying to run a business, and then all of a sudden you can't because some unknown third party pulls this kind of crap. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why people are allowed to do it. I mean, in this particular case, this was such a brazenly absurd business practice. I mean, do they actually think now that I'm going to go buy a .usa domain from them after being treated this way? Well, I sent them an invoice for $1,000 a day,
mm-hmm.
3 days. And I haven't heard anything back from them.
Doug said he didn't really expect to hear back from them, so I asked him if he considered maybe bringing it to a collection agency.
I have. and I'm actually going to look around to see if there's an agency that will take it. A couple of years ago, I heard of a circumstance like this happening, where an agency did take a billing from an internet user, a business, who had been shut down by a denial of service attack of a similar type, and the collection agency made every effort to try to get the money. I don't know if they were successful or not. The other option I suppose I would have would be a small claims court either here or in California, but it's unclear to me where this company does business. They were very clever. The .usa.com domain was taken out by a company in England. The server is located in England. The email was coming from England. The so-called removal mechanism that they had at the bottom of the spam, that server was located in England, in London, actually. They had offices, however, in Southern California. And I kind of suspect that's where the real marketing muscle was.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I sent my invoice.
Mm-hmm.
In California also has spam laws. They're not enforced, but they have the laws, like the state of Washington does.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, who does somebody who uses the internet go to for this kind of thing? I don't know. I sent email to all of the email addresses I could find associated with the company's domain, an AOL address, and some other addresses that come up in the Whois records for those domains, telling them that they were committing a denial of service attack, that I was sending them an invoice, and I wanted it to stop. And I was receiving approximately 500 to 600 messages every 15 to 20 minutes through Monday at noon, and this started like Thursday evening the week before.
I asked Doug how much bandwidth he had available.
Oh, I'm 56K dial-up.
So that's
me trying to download, you know, 50,000 messages on a 56K modem. Oh, I think we're more common than people think. I mean, if the Comcast cable company actually did have high-speed internet down here, I might have it by now. But in truth, I do publishing to a website, and I do most of my work offline. I need email, so I don't really need a high-speed internet connection. It would be nice to have one, but if I don't have it, I'm not really missing too much. And in previous jobs, I did have access to a high-speed connection if I needed to do a backup or something. So the speed of my connection doesn't really bother me too much. Right, and even if I did have a high-speed connection, I would still be receiving all of these messages, and perhaps a whole lot faster. Because I still think that I think one of my messages to the Whois records finally stopped it. I kind of suspect that's what happened. That and my ISP finally discovered that they'd ignored me for 2 days, and somebody did go in there and begin deleting messages by the time I logged in again on Monday. Even if I had a high-speed connection, I still would have been faced with a huge number of emails coming in that I would have to have deleted off my local PC. And, you know, I was talking, there were small messages, about 1.5K a piece. But on an old Windows 95 PC, that's taking up a lot of space.
At this point, the conversation turned to technical matters, and I asked Doug if he knew what caused your door to crash.
No, I don't know what, I actually, not what, I have no idea why Eudora choked. It's a good product. I've used it since Eudora 1, you know, back in the old days of the internet, and I've kind of grown up with it.
Sure.
The latest version. It's a very nice product. I think what happened was that the ISP that has my email account has some sort of a timeout timer. If it feels like it's open for too long, waiting for the network to behave or for a knack and that sort of thing, it shuts down. Because that's what happened. I don't think it was Eudora that actually crashed.
Okay.
I got some sort of timeout problem, and I was unable to reconnect for about 24 hours.
I thought that perhaps by putting in a timeout timer, Doug's ISP was maybe attempting to enable some sort of a anti-spam scheme of their own. I asked Doug to talk to this point.
Couldn't even talk to them. That's the real frustrating part.
Absolutely.
I don't think that my ISP actually got back to me 5 days after the fact.
Which
is, they asked me if I still needed help.
That's about 5 days too long.
Yeah, and I politely sent them, a response email back saying thank you, no thank you. You must have had somebody there who took pity on me and started deleting the messages, and I sort of finished up, and I just sat there and deleted 700 messages every 20 or 30 minutes on Monday morning until it stopped, and it looks like everything's cool.
Now, at this point, I thought that perhaps with the sheer mass of the emails being deleted, that there's probably something important in there that got deleted accidentally as well.
I'm sure it did. Just a week prior to that, this same ISP deleted my email account entirely by accident. That's the second time that's happened in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they have so far been unable or don't want to explain why it happens. A lot of small businesses, and I think I can say this from, at least from my own perspective, and from some of the other people that I've known, they're really at the mercy of some of these ISPs. I only pay out, about $80 a month for internet services to one company.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not thousands of dollars a month, so why should they care what happens to me? And that's basically the treatment that I've been used to since about 1997. When I started with this company in 1995, it was a mom-and-pop operation based in Walnut Creek, California. And it's since gone through two or three acquisitions, and now it's become one of these monstrous, ever-growing internet, providers, a local provider and also a web host provider, and they just don't care. They either don't have the money to care or they just don't care. As long as they've got your money, you're fine. We're in a customer no-service era, I'm thoroughly convinced.
I pointed out at this point that it's great to do business with the mom-and-pop ISP or the mom-and-pop business of any sort, but that the root problem when you do this is that you get yourself away from any kind of extreme, or I believe the term I used at the time was stellar technology, that a large corporate ISP could provide you with.
You can have all the stellar technology in the world, but if you can't end an attack like this while it's in progress, what good is the internet? I mean, if a single company, there had to be other people like me also getting spammed in this way by .usa.com.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else was probably also suffering in the same way, because there are a lot of people who own a domain and get their email in the same fashion I do. I mean, I have the flexibility of creating all the different kinds of usernames I want to and having mail to those usernames come to me. And there's got to be hundreds of other small businesses that do the same thing. What happened to them? And how does a small business, or how does anybody, stop a denial of service attack and get the kind of cooperation that you need? All you can do is send an email. But email like this goes into a black hole, because nobody wants to assume responsibility for the bad guy. Because if they do, then they believe that you're going to come after them and sue them. I think that's where the paranoia comes. And I think in the case of this California company that had all of its servers in England, they figure that if the servers are across the big pond, that they're going to get into a whole lot less trouble, or people are going to be less able to deal with them. And I think they're really hiding behind the Atlantic Ocean. They're cowardly, stupid, Me Too marketing people. I think that the internet and the software industry are full of them. When we moved from, my wife and I recently moved from California to Maryland, and what we found, I don't know if they figured out that we moved or not, but the spam count every morning, I might download 75 messages every morning when I wake up, and 55 of them are spam from all over the world. And I report the most egregious stuff, the pornographic garbage, and anything else that looks raunchy through spamcop.com,
mm-hmm.
which I think is a very valuable service.
I don't know
if anything actually happens to a lot of the stuff that I report, but it makes me feel better in the morning.
This led to a discussion of what to do about spam.
Well, I think we're in a customer no service era.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I just don't know what to do about it. I'm one of those people who believes in the less federal regulation you have, chances are the better world you're going to have.
This would be a libertarian stance, basically.
Yeah, but I'm not a libertarian per se.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an anarchist. I think more. I would love to see business behave like with some ethics, and I think business over the last 10 years, particularly with the greed that's been shown in the internet rise, the rise and fall of the internet, the software business, the bankers have and the sleazy marketing people have really destroyed things. They've taken a good thing and just turned it into garbage. I mean, this company, .usa.com, probably has a good product. They're selling .usa domains. Everybody should be proud to own one. But instead of finding a legitimate way to market their product, advertise their product, they choose to hijack other servers and or take advantage of their own, provider. And I think one of them was ntlworld.com in England. I just can't, for the life of me, figure out how somebody can feel good about doing business this way. But the only thing, they must be making money, though. I mean, people must be responding to the spam or they wouldn't be sending it. I mean, you have to stop and wonder why companies keep doing this. They probably do it because consumers get the messages and respond to the messages. They've got, I'm sure these marketing people have the studies to indicate that they're doing it. If we respond to spam, if we don't complain about spam, if we ignore it, it's going to stay with us. And I think as consumers, we could drive it out of business long before the government could, but we're going to have to figure out a way to do it. One of the ways for me to do it was to join spamcop.net and pay a very modest annual fee and report it as I get it. I reported probably 50 or 60 of those messages that came in, but I was not able to tell going back and looking at the reports that I'd made whether anything had actually been done or responded to. You know, I still feel like, you feel like you're a victim of a burglary or a theft.
Yes,
somebody has been allowed to come into your home, take what they wanted, to have their way with you, and leave, and you can't do anything about it. They just got away with it. Hardy har har.
Yes, I can see it would leave you feeling rather violated.
Well, yeah, it's a little strong, but that's the basic idea, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it made me feel exactly like I felt in June of this year when I had my Jeep broken into and $4,000 worth of electronic equipment stolen out of the back.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of felt the same way. And I think anger at not being heard, at not having the people responsible for those domains respond to it in kind and say, oh, we're sorry, Mr. Smith, we won't do that again. I'll feel a lot better if they send me a check for $3,000 for my invoice, but I know that's not going to happen.
So now I wonder, how much longer can we keep this up? How much longer before Joe Sixpack finally revolts, says enough, and tries to bring this to a stop?
I don't think companies are concerned about Joe Sixpack anymore. I think that the marketing and the salespeople that are now in charge of most companies are only interested in the bottom line sales. They will exploit the products that they have. They will, they will exploit any method open to them to get the message out. And they're not going to be kind about it because they are engaged in what they feel is a kind of a war. And I've never considered my view of, okay, maybe my view of competition is utopian, but I've always thought that people shouldn't compete on product quality, the uniqueness of their product, whether they can convince the customer in a legitimate and moral way to buy it or not buy it. Not by forcing it down our throats through methods that are questionable, to say the least. To me, these spammers are like graffiti vandals. They're like people who paint ugly scrawls on a beautiful wall that doesn't belong to them. They're no different than a vandal or a thief. I don't understand why people like that still have jobs, and why a out of work senior software producer from the Silicon Valley like myself has been out of work for 8 months. Maybe it's because I'm a dreamer. Maybe I just don't fit into that crowd anymore.
Doug, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, sir. Thanks very much.
And that was Doug Smith, the owner of several websites, who recently suffered a de facto denial of service attack, which resulted from spamming. And we spoke to him last Sunday. You're listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM, WRPI Troy.
This is WRPI Troy at 91.5 FM and live on the internet at www.wrpi.org.
3, 2, 1, 0!
And you are listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy, New York. The show is Little Brother. The topic is technology, and today's topic, spam. So what do you think of that interview, Fong?
Oh, that poor, poor man. Unfortunately, all too familiar. In fact, it reminds me of a story from when I was doing a tech support back in the day. I had a customer who was also a friend of mine who had similar situation. He had a virtual domain name that was hosted with us, and a little different situation. He had someone who sent out a spam to a lot of people, but used a fake address that happened to be at his domain name as a fake from address. So when all the bounce backs and complaints came flooding back, it ended up in my friend's email box, and ended up hosing up his email account and kind of hitting our mail server pretty hard for the day. And he dropped by the office actually on that day to tend to the problem, and he walked through the door and he didn't even say anything. I just looked up and said, "You've got mail." He sighed and said, yeah.
Yeah, I can see how it would be hard to resist making a crack like that. That's actually one of the things that that Doug did not mention, and I'm sure it's mostly because he didn't know, was exactly what kind of an effect this had on other users of his internet provider, because...
it's a shared resource.
Yeah, it is. And like he said, he wasn't able to get any real assistance from them at all, which is really unfortunate. And he brought up repeatedly the point that that we seem to live in an era of customer non-service or no service, or occasionally even customer disservice.
Yeah.
And I can certainly vouch for that one.
Now, did I follow right? Was it a larger ISP?
Well, it started out as a mom and pop when he first signed on.
Oh, one of these.
And it was one of these that merged and merged and merged and merged.
been on the other side of that, know all about it. But luckily for my guy back in those days, he just could just, you know, walk through the door, and if we didn't take care of the problem, he could pop me in the head if he wanted to. But not, you know, that's becoming all too infrequent in these days as the internet becomes corporatized.
Well, there was actually one article I was looking at and considering for the show. I don't believe I actually did decide to go with it, but I will make a quick mention of it. It was saying that about this time last year, there were 101 or so major corporations that ran most of the internet, and it's at this point down to approximately 16.
I think not in terms of specifically runs the internet, but I heard that some figure of like 50% of the content available on the internet is now coming from like five big players.
Yeah,
which is unfortunate.
Well, I mean, in order to get the content, it has to filter through your provider.
Yeah,
and the providers themselves are all consolidating as well,
which kind of plays into a phenomenon which I've noticed and been unhappy with, being an old schooler on the internet, is that the internet's becoming so much more passive. Don't you agree?
You could make that argument.
Mm-hmm.
People are more just sort of going in, finding something to watch, and watching it.
Yeah. Like, in the beginning, it was all about interactivity, and it was a virtual community in so many ways. And those just don't... I mean, you have your AOL chat rooms and everything, but it's just... I don't know. It's just... It's almost like holding pens run by, I don't know, these large behemoths, instead of people who are gathering together in a grassroots way because they want it to be. And besides that, it's all just web content that's provided from some large provider for you to passively read, and it's just becomes so much more like television.
You're not in the loop.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And it's actually one of the things that makes makes some of Doug's websites worth visiting.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst the ones he operates, there's one called popularwireless.com. He made mention of that during the interview. And it's if you can imagine taking an old-school BBS from the dial-up days and putting a web interface on it, you would have
nice.
Popular Wireless. It's it's a very nice site.
Huh.
And one that, if you go there and you look, you're going to see the name Critter splattered all over it. I think you can probably figure out where that came from.
It's ironic to me because the nature, or actually the mechanism that caused this problem it's a feature of, I guess, what's popularly referred to as virtual mail or virtual domain service,
mm-hmm.
such that you can set up aliases, email aliases that direct your mail to different places and allow you to give out various usernames at your domain and really have them route to some other address, whether it be a Hotmail or what have you. I find it ironic because that mechanism whereby he had a default, meaning that if you write Ronald McDonald at fongaboo.com, it's still going to get to me. If you write Ronald McDonald eats poop at fongaboo.com, it's still going to get to me because I don't have any other aliases that are exceptions to that rule. So it's like a default or a catch-all. So that was the heart of his downfall here, was that he was getting individual emails, each one addressed to a different address at his domain, but they were really all getting routed by that catch-all or default to his one mailbox, and then that was getting clogged up. But here's the beautiful thing. I found that you can use that to your advantage to actually rid your life of spam. And it involves changing your practices on the internet a bit. Basically, one of the bigger sources of attracting yourself to spam is each and every time you go to a website, maybe you're signing up for something, you have to give out your email address. Most sites these days are requiring an email address when you're signing up for an account. Basically, what I do is I put that site's domain at fongaboo.com as the email address. And of course, because I have no alias for that set, it'll confirmation emails and all that fun stuff that I need to get the account working are still going to get to me. Here's the thing. If they ever sell my address to a spammer and that gets onto the spammer's list and I receive spam as a result of that, I know exactly who to blame because it's going to be addressed to so-and-so domain at fongaboo.com.
Oh, that's
so
beautiful.
At that point, I create an alias that points to both the admin and technical contact of the domain that betrayed me. Therefore, any future spam that was to be brought upon me at their hand actually gets bounced back in their face, and they receive all the spam that's ever addressed to me.
Oh, that's beautiful, man. That is absolutely a beautiful thing.
I actually have to give credit to my partner in crime, Mechno, who I don't know if he's listening today, but he actually dreamt up that idea, and I've adopted it and made it a way of life, and I pretty much eliminated spam for most of my life now. So, like, if you have a virtual domain like this guy, just point the catch-all to a brand new fresh address, start doing this, and you'll probably cut your spam by at least 90%, would be my ballpark figure.
I'm going to have to start doing that.
And then I also have other, like, draconian routines involving proc mail, whereby the few spammers that do slip in, I tag them and I put them in an alias that's pointing to multiple addresses, and I just tack their address onto spammers@fongaboo.com. Then I add them to a proc mail filter, which from that point on, any email from that address will get routed to spammers@fongaboo.com.
And let me guess, that that goes to all of them, doesn't it?
So if you spam me, from that point on, you get punished, and you receive all spam from anyone else who had ever spammed me before.
So
you all get thrown into a virtual Manhattan Island, i.e. Snake Plissken escape from New York, and you can all fend for yourselves. You guys can deal with all the spam that you all cause. You just get blacklisted.
So spammers, beware. You send email to... If you start sending email to Fongaboo, you will be punished.
Before I had that ability, I actually was lucky enough to cut out most of my spam because I caught on that most of the spam I was getting was being addressed to Fongaboo at, let's say, shellmachine.myisp.com. And that was because the majority of spammers got my name from me using TIN, which is a popular command line-based newsgroup reader. So I was lucky enough to put a proc mail entry that just bounces all mail addressed to that, because nobody who's really contacting me would be writing me at the shell machine specifically. So there's all sorts of fun tricks you can do to counteract, and that's kind of the cool thing about the internet, is that it is almost like the Wild West. There are so many ways you can be vigilant by your own hand.
Yeah, that's a good thing. The problem is that we are getting a large number of people that are joining the internet who are not technically savvy. And don't get me wrong, this is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
because I think it's something that that everybody needs to be familiar with. But we're getting a lot of people who are not technically savvy joining the internet, and they don't know how to enact these various forms of revenge with regard to spam. And of course, the problem that leads to is that the spam writers are still able to continue and still able to get some level of reply, mm-hmm. I guess, enough to keep them going.
Well, the thing is, one thing he mentioned, he said, you know, they must be making money, you know, people must actually, this must actually work. But you have to look at the proportions of things in conjunction with the fact that, of one simple principle, spam is usually no sweat off the spammer's back. They're basically commandeering other people's resources freely.
Right, exactly.
And they're not only doing that, but they're brute forcing those utilities, those resources. So the thing is, if he sends 10,000, if that spammer sends 10,000 messages to this one guy's domain, and let's say he does that for a bunch of domains, and let's say, you know, what is that really, what is that costing him other than, what is that costing the spammer other than the cost of his internet connectivity and his account at their ISP? And all they have to do in most cases is make, you know, a couple sales, maybe, you know, three or four, even depending what the service or item that
and
is
they've
for
made
sale.
It back.
They've made it back, and they, you know, even if they've kind of screwed over a user, screwed over an ISP, it doesn't matter. They've reaped the benefit for, you know, infinitesimal amounts of investment.
Hmm.
So, you know, the truth is that the majority of people are not responding to spam, but all you need is just, like, you know, one or two weirdos, of which one my father is apparently one of.
He's been responding to spam.
Not only is he responding to spam, but he lost his account, his password to his Hotmail account, and Hotmail, with all my attempts, I couldn't get Hotmail to send it to him or to me. So I just created him a new fresh account. And then, once he started on an account, a few days later, he called me up and he's like, "What happened to all the advertisements I used to like getting? They're not coming anymore. Can you put those back?" And I just put the phone down, and it was in my office, and I turned to my colleague and I'm like, I am talking to my father, who's apparently the first person ever to complain about not getting spam.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So, yeah, as you can see, the fruit did fall far from the tree. But luckily,
well, it's a good thing in this case, I guess, especially given that you're given your particular line of work. Because I have a feeling that your employer would take issue with you liking spam. For those not in the know, Fongaboo here is a system administrator for one of the local internet service providers.
Yeah, I'm not an actual mail administrator, but rather a domain administrator. So that's why I get to, in terms of mail, I get to deal with the fun virtual stuff like we were talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Another comment he made was that he said it's almost like, you know, being burglarized.
Yeah.
I almost think it's almost like the converse of that, because it's almost like someone breaking into your home and leaving a bunch of crap that you didn't want.
So, somebody broke into your home and filled it full of concrete.
Or they crazy glued your lock shut.
Something like that. So, well, okay. Picture this. Door swings inward, right?
Yeah.
You fill the house full of concrete, guess what? You can't get in. I don't know. Anyway, we did have a couple other items I wanted to touch on here. One of my readers had expressed, or one of my listeners, rather, who writes me fairly regularly, had expressed an interest in this one.
So we'll bring you this article from Reuters. It says, picture a chip the size of a grain of rice that can be injected into your body and give detailed information about you to anybody with the right scanning equipment. Is this a scene from a bad science fiction film or a radical research project in some secret government laboratory? Well, the chip is neither fiction nor obscure science, but instead it is a soon-to-be-marketed product ready to make its way to customers in the year ahead. The use of high-powered chips melded to the body has been a recurrent theme of science fiction from the 1984 cyberpunk novel Neuromancer to the 1999 blockbuster film The Matrix, but the announcement of a commercial-ready product by Applied Digital Solutions this week will focus real-world attention on the potential and risks of such technology. And I would say, actually, it goes back further than that. It goes all the way back to Logan's Run, if you want to go back far. Designed to store critical personal medical data, the chip would mark the start of a more urgent debate about potential privacy invasions at a time when privacy advocates are on the defensive over anti-terror initiatives after September 11th. It's certainly going to raise issues that we haven't dealt with before, said Stephen Keating, the executive director of the Denver-based Privacy Foundation. Such radioactivated chips are already used to track cattle, house pets, and salmon. But this would mean that this would mark the first attempt to apply the technology to human beings, offering a potentially controversial means for hospitals to scan patients in emergency rooms and for governments to pick out convicted criminals. Applied Digital said Wednesday that it would begin marketing its implantable VeriChip in South America and Europe, initially as a means to convey information about medical devices to doctors who need a quick way to find out how and where patients with pacemakers, artificial joints, and other surgically implanted devices have been treated. When activated by a radio scanner, the chip would emit a radio signal of its own from under the skin that would transmit stored data to a nearby internet-equipped computer or via telephone, the company said. The chip itself would be implanted in a doctor's office with a local anesthesia, and the site of the injection would be closed without stitches. But the company already has its sights on more ambitious applications for the chip.
Why does this not surprise?
Which are currently capable of carrying the equivalent of about 6 lines of text. Future versions could emit a tracking beacon or serve as a form of personal identification. Did you see this coming?
No, not for miles.
No idea this was possibly becoming from a technology as benevolent as planting an ID chip under your skin. And sarcasm. There are enough benefits that outweigh the concerns people have about privacy. Oh, yeah? Says Applied Digital Chairman and Chief Executive Richard Sullivan. So, Richard, I assume you're going to be the first one getting one of these implants, right? Other experts remain skeptical, citing immediate practical problems such as the need to set standards that would make such chips more universally readable and longer-term concerns over civil liberties. Even so, such implants are certain to become more widespread, according to technology professor Paul Sappho. Of course we will do this, said Sappho of the Silicon Valley-based Institute for the Future, and it won't be just for the functionality, it will also be for fashion. You got a generation that's already piercing themselves. Of course they're going to put electronics under their skin.
So, the thing is that the funny scenario that came to my mind is that, on the other hand of things, when the war drivers and the 802.11 freaks get bored of that, are they going to get off the road and go in? Are they going to go into bars and nightclubs and at that point have like the ultimate like pickup tool?
Just
like get your profile or background just by like scanning you at the end of the bar.
Oh my! You know that's a great take on it, and that is one I would never have thought of.
But I kind of intrigues me the idea of almost the electronic figurative piercing, or a tattoo almost. You're branding yourself with data. I don't know. Do you think that could become in vogue?
It's certainly possible. I think. I know that the thing that I don't know if it will come in vogue or not. I mean. That's really not one of my greater concerns, although I think if it were ever to become in vogue, I would probably be one of the people warning against it very strongly.
But of course, I have a feeling that any, you know, running up against fashion, logic tends to fall on deaf ears. So I don't think it would do much good.
Their supposed benevolent use is for almost the electronic equivalent of a medical ID bracelet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was also some... I didn't go all the way down to the end of the article. I mean, if I did, we would run out of time, which we're doing anyway. But the further down in the article, it talks about using these things to track lost children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I'm... The obvious concern is if you can use this to track lost children, you can also use it to track lost adults. We don't necessarily want to be tracked.
Lojack for people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's see. We do have, on another topic, we have a statement that was made by Dmitry Sklarov on December 19th. He says... This is all in Dmitry's words. I don't know if these have been, I don't know how well he speaks English and whether he wrote this in English or whether it was translated. I'd expect his English is probably pretty good.
Is this the guy who cracked the e-books?
Yes.
Code? Okay.
He's saying, I would like to express my heartfelt appreciation to each person who has supported and contributed to me during my detention these past 5 months. Naturally, I'm very happy about returning to Russia and at the prospect of getting back to my family and friends. I'm excited about spending the holidays in my homeland. There are two points I wish to address. Today, the first point is, I am extremely disappointed with any implication that I am in any way cooperating with the government. My perspective is simply this. I'm a man of integrity, and as such, I am doing nothing more than telling the truth. I am not for or against anyone. Secondly, there seems to have been some confusion as to my employment status with Elcomsoft. I would like to clear up this confusion. I have been employed by Elcomsoft since April 2000 and will continue to remain Elcomsoft's long-distance virtual employee. Wait a minute, scratch that. Skip the line. And will continue to be employed in the future. As a matter of fact, I have remained Elcomsoft's long-distance virtual employee through these past 5 months while detained here in the United States. So, now you know how Dmitry is doing, and I had a feeling this was probably close to the mark.
Speaking of similar type characters, did you catch Kevin Mitnick on Art Bell's show last week?
No, that I didn't. I'm not usually up late enough at night to catch Art Bell, unfortunately.
Yeah, he freaked Art out by, spoofed his caller ID during the show with the FBI's number.
I see. Kevin is supposed to be behaving himself these days.
How did he do that without touching a computer? That's what I want to know.
I'm going to let that one slide because I don't think we want to dig any further into that one because if we do, we could get him back into trouble again.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Speaking of Kevin leads to 2600 leads to a lawsuit that was from some time ago. Basically, Ford sued 2600 magazine for being the owner of a website of a domain that I unfortunately can't present to you on the air. We shall suffice it to say that there's a word at the start that begins with F and is followed by the word GeneralMotors.com. In a nutshell, what 2600 Magazine did with this domain, they had it for some time, basically because of the whole reason why they had registered this domain in the first place was because suddenly the rules had loosened up to the point where you could register a domain name like this. There was a while that you had to keep your domain names decent. For lack of anything better to do with said domain name, they pointed it at Ford.com, and Ford objected. The news is that as of December 23rd, December 23rd is that on the 20th, a ruling was issued denying Ford's complaint against 2600. The judge's decision reaffirms the right of a domain name holder to point their website where they choose while the court avoided ruling on an important First Amendment issues. It claims that this is a decisive victory and we are absolutely delighted. Attorney Eric Grimm, who argued the case for $2,600, said that, actually. Court ruled consistently with the law and on all precedent.
The thing is, if you start there, then you're going to have all sorts of court cases about people hyperlinking or meta-refreshing. The whole idea of the web is that, you know, one site links to another. So I would say I'm glad they were denied with that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it looks like we're up against the clock here. Faisal Ahmed is present, and we'll be doing the window on Islam in a few minutes. So once again, we bring another episode of Little Brother to a close. Take care, everybody, and have a happy and safe new year.
Don't you ask when you wanna come.